Thank you. I'd like to first thank the organizers of this conference, and not only for the conference, but for the workshop that has preceded it for the past 2 months. I've enjoyed being here and learning a lot about electron glasses. Nonetheless, what I will be talking about has nothing to do with either interactions or disorder, but it does involve a manifestation of quantum mechanics in Casimir physics. And there is reasons to indicate why going to out of equilibrium examination of this phenomena may be interesting. So what I intend to do is to very briefly remind you of Casimir physics and the experimental progress over the last decade that has spurred a lot of activity recently, in particular in relation to using Casimir forces in design of devices. And for that, it is very important to find repulsive forces, or to somehow weaken the attractive nature of the Casimir force. I will mention a couple of proposals that people have been pursuing using boundary conditions or using shape and geometry, and then introduce a rather powerful formalism that allows us to compute Casimir forces using scattering theory. And with that, we have been able to sort of look at a variety of new shapes that were not possible a few years ago. But that's not really my intent. I will use the scattering theory instead to talk about a generalization of the Earnshaw's theorem that we have proved applicable to fluctuation-induced forces in general, that seems to put severe constraints on the type of devices that you can make that involve, say, levitating objects and repulsive Casimir forces. And of course, every theorem has its caveats, and then maybe I will try to convince you that looking at non-equilibrium phenomena can provide and help us with some of these caveats. So just a reminder of what Casimir did more than 50 years ago. He looked at two mirrors and quantized the modes of the electromagnetic field in the vacuum between them, and said each one of them quantum mechanically is a harmonic oscillator. Adding up all of the ground state energies, you will get an infinity. But because the wavelengths are quantized along the separation, there is a finite part to this infinity that actually gives you a force per unit area, or if you like, a pressure that is proportional to h bar c and it falls off as separation to the fourth power. Shortly after that, Lifshitz provided a different perspective on this, which rather than thinking about perfect mirrors, considered entities, the material that formed the boundaries, and he could find a formula for the force in terms of the dielectric properties of the medium. The thing that I would like to point out is an interesting difference in perspective, in that rather than thinking about the fluctuations of the field in vacuum, Lifshitz looked at the fluctuations of the sources, the currents that you have in the media, and you could relate that via this fluctuation dissipation theorem. And starting from that, he calculated the force depending on the properties of the medium. In the 50 years that followed, there were various attempts to look at these forces experimentally. It probably is fair to say that precise determination and comparison of theory and experiment became possible only in the last few years of the 20th century, starting with the work of Lamoureux, and then shortly afterwards with Mohyeddin's group at Riverside. And these groups were taking advantage of the technology of scanning microscopy. And say in the typical experiment by Mohyeddin, there is a microsphere of gold, not so small actually, it's about 100 micrometers in diameter, glued to a cantilever, and its separation from a plate is moved precisely through a piezo device. A laser beam is reflected off the top of the cantilever, its deflection gives you a measure of the force, and then they have been able to compare theory and experiment, let's say at the level of a few percent. Very shortly after this, there were a bunch of papers devoted to applications of these two making devices. And the key word here is MEMS, microelectromechanical systems. Basically, you want to have devices at length scales of microns that have metallic elements that are conducting. And at these scales, the Casimir force is the strongest force, and it's actually detrimental to operation of your device because it's attractive and causes your pieces to stick together and the machine fails. So there have been various questions as to how to change the nature or weaken the strength of this attractive force. So 2 years ago, I was organizer of a program at KITP where we were following more sort of academic pursuits of Casimir force. And at the same time, there was a call for proposals from DARPA that was interested in weakening Casimir force with the goal of demonstrating the ability to manipulate and engineer Casimir force, including neutralizing and weaken it for the purpose that I mentioned. And several groups then followed up on this with attempts to weaken or neutralize Casimir force or change its sign. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the proposals. Yes? Okay. It's included. If you like, it all has to do with electrons fluctuating in the material. If they are bound to atoms or molecules, you typically call it van der Waals. If they are free to move around, you call it Casimir. But where the boundary is, it's really up to you. Okay. Okay. So boundary conditions. So if you have a scalar field and you have two plates with, say, Dirichlet boundary conditions, they attract. If you have Neumann boundary conditions, they attract. If one of them is Neumann, the other is Dirichlet, they repel. So how can one use this for the case of electromagnetic field? One easy way to do it is to make sure that the nature of reflection of electromagnetic field at the boundary changes or is different between the two plates. And you could do that by having a medium between the two plates whose dielectric properties is intermediate between what you have on one side and what you have on the other side. And the classical example of this is why helium goes up and wets the walls of a glass container, because dielectric response of helium is between air and, say, glass. This was demonstrated in the 70s and computed. More recently, there was a lot of attention paid to an experiment by Capasso's group in which they floated a gold sphere using Casimir forces on top of a glass plate using as intervening material bromobenzene. So you can definitely get repulsion this way, but if you have built these tiny machines at the micron scale with lots of labors, you surely are not going to put them in some oil or fluid and have it operate that way. So what you really want to have is some way of having repulsion across vacuum. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, there was a proposal in the 70s by Boyer. He said that you could achieve the same effect by having a material like a metal on one side that excludes the electric field, has large epsilon, and on the other side you have a material that has large permeability mu and excludes the magnetic field, and then that would do it. They would repel each other. Well, there's a small problem in that any material that you can think of has mu of around 1. So you can't do that with ordinary materials. Until very recently, that a new set of materials, metamaterials, were proposed. And here you basically engineer something to have strong magnetics response by, say, putting in some dielectric material filaments at the micron scale of a metal, let's say in the form of these circuits. So you try to pass a magnetic field through, you generate eddy currents that basically oppose it, you get strong magnetic response. So this seems to have, at least in certain range of frequencies, large permeability, and a lot of people proposed this as a means of doing this. And so at the time that this was proposed, let's say New Scientist had an article about it. That is very nice, because these metamaterials are also used for left-handed light propagation cloaking devices. It sounds like science fiction joke, but it isn't. What do you get when you turn an invisibility cloak on its side? A mini flying carpet. Okay, so that's one example. And I guess my own institution, MIT's Technology Review, wrote an article with this levitating lady. That is certainly, it says nano objects levitate, but this is not so nano, I guess. So another type of proposal, I'll come back to this, whether it's practical or not. Another type of proposal that takes advantage of a different property, that Casimir forces are very shape dependent. I guess it goes back to some thing that also Casimir was involved with, which is a model originally by Abraham and Lorentz for an electron. So thinking of an electron as, let's say, a shell, metallic shell with the electric charge E on it and radius R, then there is a self-energy that goes like E squared over R that gets larger and larger as R goes to zero. You want to have a point electron, so you have an infinity. Casimir, sort of reflecting on this, said, well, I know that if I have plates, there is a finite part of this mode energy and the zero-point energy. On dimensional ground, that I know that for a sphere, there should be a modification that should scale as h bar c over r. So maybe what I can do is to have a balance between them and a result that will be independent of how small r is. But that's only going to work as long as the ratio of E squared over H bar C is compensated by whatever this prefactor is. So if I do that, then I have found the fine structure constant. So this was pursued by Boyer in the 60s, and he did the computation that Casimir had not done, and came to the conclusion that while parallel plates are attracted together because of zero-point energy, a conducting sphere tends to be expanded. So the direction of the force that he found was in the same direction, and the Casimir proposal for this electron and fine structure constant does not work, but then it generated interest. Maybe we can make repulsive Casimir forces using geometry. And the sphere is not the only case. You can take a parallelopiped, something that is like a cube. A cube, it is more or less repulsive like a sphere. You stretch and you change the dimension, and depending on the aspect ratios, you can get things that are attractive or repulsive. So then people proposed devices based on this. They said, okay, we'll make a lot of grooves that are kind of in the right aspect ratio that we have on the parallelopiped, and then we can float something above them. And there is this proposed machine that was actually for a while funded by NASA. Well, what we did recently was we said, okay, what does it mean that there are stresses on this that want to change the side of this? If I try to distort the cube or the sphere in any way, I have to change surface area, volume, surface tension, all kinds of things I have to fight with. So it's not experimentally feasible to do this geometry. What we did was we essentially just inserted a plate in between. So there is a movable partition that can move in here and ask what happens to that partition. And we can do the calculation very simply by just adding results for two cubes. We find that the partition is always attracted to the closer side. And the point in between is unstable no matter what you do. That's really what you, all you see. So these devices are not going to work. There was a proposal that maybe if we cut the sphere in half, the two halves of the sphere will repel each other. Well, nobody had calculated half spheres before, but Click and Kenneth proved a very nice theorem that as long as you have a mirror symmetry, the two things that are on the side of the mirror will attract to each other. So that does not work either. But these things actually don't go away. There is a recent proposal, which I believe is correct, proposed by Mike Levine and Steve Johnson and his group at MIT, in which you cut a hole in a plate and you have something like an ellipsoid. One can show that the ellipsoid will shoot out of this thing if you put it right at the center. So there is repulsion in this sense. But I'll come back to that. So we see that there are lots of cases where there are different geometries, different shapes, etc. We would like to be able to compute Casimir forces for design of devices. If we want to follow Casimir's procedure of calculating modes and ground state, it's basically impractical. There is another method that we have developed into a way that is practical recently that allows you to compute Casimir forces between any collection of objects. I have drawn two objects here, but it could have been more, it could have been five, as many as you like. And the things that you need in order to calculate the Casimir force, number one, you need to know how light scatters from each individual object. So you basically impinge light, it goes away, and you can describe that by a scattering amplitude, or if you like, a matrix, which is dependent on the basis that you want to choose for describing incoming and outgoing waves. So that's element number one that we will indicate typically by the matrix T. You have one matrix for this object, one matrix for that object, so you can have multiple objects. The other thing that you need is basically how to convert an outgoing wave framed on this object into incoming waves that you have on the other object. And those things we can describe through some matrices like U. Let's think about this in another way. Let's say if you think about these things in the coordinates of impinging and outgoing spherical waves, rather than thinking of waves, we could also think about current fluctuations on the object, and there will be multiples of charge current on these objects. And these T matrices can be related to how easy it is to create a multiple fluctuation on one object. And the U matrices can be related to essentially the Coulomb interaction that you have between multiple on one object and a multiple on the other object. And then there is a formula for computing the result out of all of these fluctuating charge currents. Now, using this
information about
distance between these two objects is in U, yes. Orientation, geometry, distance, everything is in U. One object, yes, which could be at infinity, and you can see that we essentially, the other matrix is subtracting the energy where the objects are separated to infinity and the U's have gone to zero. So basically, a lot of infinities are removed by multiplying two objects or subtracting two energies, if you like. Yes? Okay, that's indicated roughly here. The only constraint is that there should be non-overlapping perimeters. So like the things that I have indicated here, if there's two circles that I can draw around them, as long as the two circles don't overlap, this will work. The thing is that as they come closer to each other, we need, in the language of multiples, more and more multiples. So it's exactly like you would do for a interaction between two electrostatic objects in terms of a multiple expansion. Okay? So what we have focused recently is essentially a number of shapes for which the information about scattering can be obtained exactly. Of course, for planes, it is easy. Things get reflected, so the T matrix is one. Spheres, they are known as mean scattering. We use them to calculate the interaction between sphere and plate only recently. Cylinders, paraboloids, cones, and wedges. These two last things are interesting because they have sharp shapes. And basically, there are only a few things you can go and look up in Morse and Fischbach where the electromagnetic field can be written in separable form and things can be calculated exactly. And this, to lowest order, basically exhausts all possible objects. But we could have multiple of these objects. But that's not what I want to focus on. That's really topic full. That's a so-called parabolic cylinder. So it's a parabola that is extended in the other direction. The other thing that I don't have here is an elliptic cylinder, but that's basically the only thing that is left. Okay? So I want to go back to the story of repolishing. Now, in the realm of not having Casimir effects on ordinary objects, typically you rule out repulsion in most cases by Earnshaw's theorem. So basically, to remind you, Earnshaw's theorem says that you cannot have a charge that is in stable equilibrium held by electrostatic forces from some other bunch of charges. Why is that? Very simple, because let's say look at this charge. If I wasn't there, the potential that it would feel once it's placed there is the solution to Laplace's equation. Laplace's equation says that if you are in a position where the force is zero and you are stable in one direction, you must be unstable in the other direction, right? And so if this thing, for example, is stable because it is repelled from that side, it will be unstable and fly off the other side. Now, we have been able to show that this is true for Casimir forces, but the calculations for Casimir forces are rather difficult. On the other hand, I don't want to not give you an intuition, so I will show you a classical example where there are fluctuating charges, and the reason why you see this is actually very easy to describe. So in the case of Casimir, we have the objects where there are quantum fluctuations creating charge and currents, and there are these interactions between them. Let's sort of substitute that with another example in which I have containers. Within each container, I have classical charges that can pop in and out of existence and that can fluctuate around. So this could be a model of containers full of electrolytes, if you like. And the question is whether I can hold one container stably in the presence of all these other containers with their fluctuating charges. Well, when I have things that are fluctuating, let's say at finite temperature, I shouldn't be calculating energies, I should be calculating free energies. Free energy, I need to calculate the log of a partition function. The partition function is obtained by integrating over all positions, numbers of these fluctuating charges, weighted by the Coulomb potential in the exponent e to the minus beta h. So actually, h will have the Coulomb interaction with all of the charges, but it could have lots of other interactions due to hard-coring things and things that confine the charges to containers, etc. Now, the question of stability of one of these containers is what happens to the second derivative of the free energy, the analog of the Laplacian of the energy that I had before. Well, if this is the free energy, it is very easy to calculate two derivatives with respect to D. The only place that D appears is in these coordinates. And so basically, what I will end up with when I take derivatives is to bring down derivatives of this Hamiltonian. And there are two terms. One term is just the second derivative of the interaction. And this term is actually zero because we are dealing with the Coulomb interaction. As long as the charges don't overlap and the containers are arranged so as to avoid that, this is zero. And the other part is the fluctuations in force, the variance of force, which we know the variance of any quantity has a particular sign and gives you instability. Basically, it says that if I were to take an instantaneous picture, I know because of Earnshaw's theorem that the thing is unstable. As the charges move around, I will get fluctuating forces on this object. And the variance of the fluctuating forces gives you additional instability. Okay, so fluctuations tend to enhance instability. So now we have been able to prove the version of this that is applicable to Casimir forces using this scattering formalism that I mentioned. Basically, we looked at one object, which is our test object, and we said all the other objects we are going to combine together and call them rest of the universe. and then we have a 2x2 matrix that determines the energy. We can take two derivatives, and there's lots of manipulations involved. The end of the story is that indeed the Laplacian of the Casimir energy is negative as long as the T matrices have the same sign. And the other part of the story is that one can show that as long as your objects are described locally by a dielectric constant epsilon, that could be a function of position, so from here to here, and the object it could vary with frequency in whatever way, there is a constraint on epsilon evaluated at imaginary frequencies for stability, and as long as that epsilon is larger than epsilon of the medium, which if the medium is one is always satisfied, then the sign of this is positive and you cannot have unstable levitation. Okay, so what I haven't written is epsilon function of x and x prime. We have the sketch of the calculation and how it will be generalized in that fashion. I strongly believe that we can generalize it to that case, but since I haven't done it yet, I will not say it definitely. Okay, we think that we can generalize this for anisotropic media, non-local media, and so forth. Okay? There is one constraint that for this, currently we've assumed also that the material has mu of one. And this is true for the metamaterial that I showed you because the metamaterial is composed of these circuits of metal that were embedded in a dielectric. So epsilon is locally either large or small, but mu is always close to one as you go across the material. This is also valid for finite temperature. As I said, it seems to rule out repulsion for metamaterials and a whole lot of other cases. Now, of course, every theorem has caveats, and if you Google Earnshaw's theorem, you will actually come across a lot of things that are supposed to violate that and show levitation. For example, we all have seen pictures of optical tweezers manipulating and moving things around. The reason it works is because you have an oscillating electromagnetic field, it's not electrostatics. And Boris was asking me about the frog levitating on the magnet. You probably have seen this movie. Again, it's because the frog is very dielectric, the field is strong, and this condition is not covered by Earnshaw's theorem. So if we want to get repulsion, we have to go off some of the conditions of the theorem that I outlined, and certainly equilibrium was one of them. So I'm involved with the group of Riverside with Omar Mohyeddin, and we have several stages to our proposals. The simplest one to imagine is the following, that he is proposing to use indium tin oxide, which is a transparent electrode rather than a metal, yes? And if you do so, then you can pass a laser right from one side, and the pressure of the laser can counteract the attraction that you have from Casimir forces, and say 32 milliwatts of laser power can counteract the force that you have at 100 nanometers. But maybe another way of achieving the same thing is to think of two plates. One of them you heat up, and the other you keep cool. Of course, you have to constantly supply energy to remove heat from one side. And then you have essentially thermal radiation pressure from one side acting on the other. And very hand-waving, you would say that Stefan Boltzmann law gives you pressure that is Stefan's constant T to the fourth. You can balance it against the pressure due to Casimir forces H bar C over D. You see that this will work and give you repulsion, but the distance has to be larger than the only length scale that you can construct here, which is kT over h bar c, the thermal wavelength, which for, say, room temperature is 7 microns. So in principle, you can do this, but 7 microns is too big. You want to have repulsion at shorter distances. Now, if you bring these plates shorter to each other, closer to each other, actually, then Stefan Boltzmann law doesn't work. And Anton Ezra, Pitaevsky, Stringari, Tov have developed a generalization of Lifshitz theory that is applicable to calculating Casimir forces between plates that are at different temperature. The starting point, like Lifshitz, is the fluctuating currents that you have in each body. You assume that for each body separately, you will use fluctuation dissipation theorem to relate it to the temperature of that body. Once you have the currents, you calculate the electromagnetic field in the vacuum. You can calculate stress tensor. You can calculate whatever you like. Now, we were hoping to use this formalism in connection with something else that was taking advantage of resonance phenomena. This is a paper that shows that the van der Waals interaction between two atoms can be made repulsive if they are at different temperature. Essentially, the occupations of the different states are according to different temperatures. And we were hoping that we would embed on top of our surfaces or inside the surfaces lots of these resonances, and then we would get repulsion that way. Turns out that because of many body effects, it doesn't work. So that didn't work. But actually, there is lots of interesting things to think about when we come to electromagnetic fields radiated by objects at these short length scales. For example, essentially the assumption of black body, Stefan Boltzmann, etc., is that the wavelengths that you are looking at are smaller than the typical size of objects that are emitting them. This can be violated when you have a nanotube. So what happens to those laws? And indeed, the transfer of heat has been measured between a nanosphere and a plate. And again, it's orders of magnitude larger than what you would have expected on the basis of, say, standard calculations that we do for general exams, emission from a sphere, etc. So there is a lot of work that to be done, and what we are currently engaged in is generalizing the scattering theory approach that I outlined for calculating Casimir forces in equilibrium to calculating properties of electromagnetic field, etc., when the objects that we are looking at are at different temperatures. We could calculate things like radiation as well as Casimir forces. So basically, what I hope I have convinced you is that Casimir force, having moved from theory to experiment, has now actually encroached upon applications, and there's, in particular in connection with MEMS, lots of interest in controlling and potentially weakening the Casimir force. There are several projects that have been followed up for looking at repulsive Casimir forces, either with metamaterials, taking advantage of boundaries, or taking advantage of geometry and shape. But there is this Earnshaw's theorem that puts severe constraint on what can be done and can't be done, at least as long as you are in equilibrium. But maybe if you go to off equilibrium, you have a chance. And so this has been work that has been done over the past few years with the group at MIT centered around Bob Jaffe. Thorsten Emig at Cologne has been an important collaborator, and there's a bunch of other students and postdocs who have been very active in our group. Thank you very much.
I didn't understand why the frog levitating was out of equilibrium.
Oh, that was it. So that was an example of the standard Earnshaw's theorem, nothing having to do with fluctuations and Casimir being violated. The reason it is violated is because if you look at the extension of Earnshaw's theorem when you have materials that are described by dielectric or permeability. And it turns out that a dielectric, a mu that is less than one, is a condition that violates Earnshaw's theorem. And the frog is mostly composed of water, which is diamagnetic.
So, and the same thing applies with magnetic forces, that there's an equilibrium, but if you have a diamagnetic material, you
similarly... That's right. Diamagnetic materials violate the original Earnshaw's theorem. And for us, actually, if we could find materials with large mu, we would also violate our theorem. But fortunately, unfortunately, those materials don't exist. Mu that is larger than one. Paramagnetic, not that. Well, that's what I was saying. You can work it at this one frequency, but for Casimir force, you have to look both at imaginary components, frequencies, and all frequencies, and then it doesn't work.
So you want to overcome Casimir attraction by some kind of repulsion. Mm-hmm. So probably it's a stupid suggestion, but why can't you just charge these plates?
You could, yes. So it's just that most of the applications that they have in mind is in connection with MEMS. It has to be electromechanical. They want to have metallic objects that pass current. So you want to not really charge your objects. You want to be able to pass currents, and they should be good conductors. That's why indium tin oxide, which is a conductor as opposed to, say, a silicon wafer or some other thing that you can indeed charge, and then you can keep them apart.
Any more questions?
There is one other type of experiments where Casimir force is a big impediment, mm-hmm. measuring gravitational forces at small distances.
Yes.
Any suggestion what they can do to remove or neutralize Casimir forces?
I think there actually the question is not so much having to remove or neutralize it, but being able to accurately account for how big it is. Because what you want to know is whether there is an additional fifth force or whatever on top of what you have. So if you know the Casimir force with sufficient accuracy and your stuff is precise enough, you could essentially subtract it off. So that's what people have been doing mostly. So, and the Casimir forces these days, people can predict for nice geometries to say 1% accuracy.
But that's sufficient for?
I think that's sufficient for these applications.
So any more? Let's send the speaker. Our next speaker is Christian Ernst from Heidelberg University.